The interview today is with Clara Christine Johnson, more commonly known as Chris. We are interviewing at the Air Force Village One in San Antonio, Texas, for the Women's Overseas Service League. I am Ruth Stewart. Chris, start in by telling us a little bit about your early life.
Well, I was born in Jackson, Mississippi. My father was a letter carrier for the city of Jackson, and his route was the governor's route. And consequently, I, as a black child, had a more privileged upbringing because my father had a position that provided for us. But you can realize that people want to venture out, and consequently at the age of six, my folks moved away and we moved to Chicago. And that's where I went to school and began my college career at the time that I came in the Air Force in 1950. And my reason for joining the Air Force at that time was because there was just nothing available for a young black female. I had a position with the theater group as a stage designer, but I couldn't join the union because I didn't have the $500. So therefore, I was frustrated in that I couldn't be retained in my job, so I went looking for a job, and there was a sign on the corner that said, "Uncle Sam wants you." And I went in, assuming that I was going to be turned away, but I wasn't. And I think that the reason that I was taken on the spot, really very short interview, was because I had some college. And that was very necessary at the time, because the skills that I came with only needed developing. They didn't have to do more for me. So began my military career. From Chicago, in early December of 1950, eight young women were placed on an airplane, and we flew to Little Rock, Arkansas, where we had lunch, and we joined with 20 other young women, and we were flown here to San Antonio. Welcome to San Antonio. It was November, and I had just left Chicago, cold, snowing, and we had weather almost like we had today, and that is 60 degrees, and you could see 40 young women shedding coats and boots and babushkas, that we, as we called them in those days. We began a friendship of those 40 young women that is still lasting for those that are still alive. It's amazing how you can bond together in such a short time. And I was always impressed with my female colleagues in that I was the only person of color, and they were readily accepting. And this was something that you find very odd and strange, particularly in the early 50s.
I'm sure it would be.
Yeah.
So then coming here to San Antonio, was that for training?
I came to San Antonio for basic training. The old 3743rd training command
What was that?
3743rd. I've been over to visit Lackland since I've been back, and all the training squadrons have since been renumbered, so therefore it's no longer alive. It's been retired. It was 8 weeks and 12 weeks, but we had a 8 week training session. It was interesting because we were trying to be as competitive as we could with the male training squads. And we had some TAC officers and TAC sergeants, training sergeants, shall I say, that were very competitive. And they wanted us to be competitive. And they realized something that we didn't yet know, that in order to survive in the Air Force, you were going to have to be competitive. It was only the person that was the most competitive that would survive. And I gather that this is pretty much the same today, but not as much so then, because women were small in number and just beginning to find their place or their niche. So therefore, we had to survive. We're here, we're going to survive, we're going to stay. We were the trailblazers. From Lackland, I went to Brooks Field. And I joined the WAF squadron there and worked in the Special Services Unit. And because of my training that I had in my civilian life as a stage set designer, I became a float designer. And a float designer, we did floats for the Fiesta. The Air Force put a float in Brooks, put a float in each parade, the Riverboat Parade, the Battle of the Flowers Parade. You name it, we were busy building floats.
And no place are there more parades than San Antonio.
That's right. But I also went TDY to Los Angeles to work on floats that the government might have in the Rose Bowl Parade. And I also worked on floats in Cheyenne, Wyoming, in Frontier Day Parade. So I was very active there for about 3 years, being in special services and learning new components of the special services unit, being a librarian, being in the testing services, running a service club. I got all of those things that was there I took advantage of. But I realized that I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. I would like to be able to do something that I've been trained to do and use my talents for, which I felt more comfortable in. So from there, I applied for Officer Candidate School. And in November of 1953, I came back to Lackland to become a member of the class of 1954-8. And that was 6 months of training, but that 6 months of training was like combat, because President Eisenhower and his government at that time felt that they had to have some financial constraints with the military. So therefore, the upper class that we had were not assured of receiving a commission once they graduated. And there was well over 200 of them. And there was only 125 in my class. But for every one of us that washed out, it meant that would be a commission that my upper class could have. So believe me, they tried to wash out as many of us as they could.
Because this was all women?
No.
No, just...
There was 125 of us, of which only three were women. Only three. And all three of us survived. There was a young woman from Hawaii, a young woman from New York, and myself from Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
It meant all, expanding all of our energies in order to be successful. Because if there was any way that we could have been washed down, it was tried. So we had to wash each other's back. We had to learn how to be team players, be team members, be supportive of each other's. Again, skills that we could use for the very remainder of our careers if successful. I can recall that while I was in OCS, my father died. And I left in the end of November to go to the funeral. I was gone for 3 days. But those 3 days that I was gone, there was midterm exams. And I was told that as soon as I came back to base, I would be tested. And I can remember when the plane landed, that five of my classmates met me, and we stayed in the airport for almost 3 hours while they drilled me and asked me questions. They didn't give me any answers, but they drilled me and drilled me and drilled me so that I could sit for that exam, because when I arrived on base and signed in, I went immediately from the squadron in to sit for the exam. Which meant that was another
great stress.
Which was another tactic of trying to wash me out, because there's no way that she can pass this exam. Because she wasn't here.
Your father's death.
My father's death. I'm stressed. But they forgot that we had a team full of young people.
What a wonderful story.
All 125 of us bonding together. We really, I don't remember exactly, but I would have to say that we only lost about four.
Mm-hmm.
We were determined.
Wonderful.
We were supportive of each other. Well, anyway, I passed the exam. I mean, just barely. I had to get 65 out of 100, I got 65.
Oh, gosh.
I passed. Yeah, I passed. It was interesting. It was really interesting. We had the physical before we accept our commissions. We had to pass the physical. I had a little hemorrhoid problem, so they said it was something that would have to be dealt with before I graduated. Well, consequently, I had this surgery, and I could only be in the hospital for 2 days. Well, I was there for 2 days, and back drilling and back parading, and I survived. I had my doubts there for a while, but I survived. From one graduation in March of 54, I was assigned to Cheyenne, Wyoming. And at Cheyenne, Wyoming, first thing I can remember, Billy Bobbitt was the commander of the WAF squadron there, and I was assigned as her adjutant. Frontier days. I've read your file. Cheyenne, we need a float.
But I just got here. What kind of materials do I have to work with?
Oh, dear. rallied around and got the support of the fire department, the motor pool. We got a soup carrier and we built onto it, and believe it or not, in less than 3 weeks, we had a float. But while there, I attended the fly officer school. And being a biochemistry major in college, I found that being a fuels officer, or either a special weapons officer, probably would be the area that I would like to get into. Didn't happen. I wound up in regular supply. And because of the shortage of fully qualified supply officers, and I had been classified coming out of school as being capable of assuming responsibilities beyond my rank. And I left Cheyenne and went to a supply depot in Wales. And from Wales, I went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Before we leave Wales, tell us about the way you lived there and what it was like to be in.
Well, we were actually stationed at an RAF station, RAF Station Sealand. We had a supply depot, and we had the subsistence depot. Subsistence depot was responsible for stocking all of the commissaries throughout the United Kingdom. We lived in a RAF officer quarters, and many of the officers had the Batman. I always wanted a Batman, but I never got one. It would have been nice to have somebody press my uniforms and have my tea waiting for me, but it never happened. We had a cadre of RAF officers, and we had the British Constabulary, and it marched quick time and saluted with a little bit of more of a snap than the American forces did. We were always saying, come on, Lieutenant, you must learn to do this properly. So therefore, I actually came out of Sealand being a combination of both British and American, but with a little bit more of a snap to my step than the average person would have, and that's because the young people there, the young troops there, was determined that if I was going to be stationed on their base, I was going to learn to do it their way. It was interesting. And whenever we had the parade, and once a month we had a parade, we would come, West Squadron and all the other squadrons, and the commander would stand and watch us as we passed in review. But I also had another review team, the British Constabulary, as they would all stand there and applaud as I came.
Your cheering section.
Oh, my own cheering section. I was very interested. My own cheering section. I loved them dearly, and I think it was common between both factions there.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed there and for 4 years, and we closed Sealand.
You went there what year?
In 1954.
1954 to 1958.
No, 57.
58. Okay.
Because it closed. And we were reassigned back to the United States rather than be reassigned someplace else in the United Kingdom or in Germany for 1 year. They chose to send us back. The United States. But it was interesting because we wanted to close out all of the books, and the more we tried to close out the books and sell equipment and close the officers club, and we chartered a boat and we went to Ireland for St. Patrick's Day. They had slot machines on board the ship, so actually we made money. Interesting. Really, really interesting. I left Sealand and went to Wright-Patterson. And I was at the AMC, the old Air Materiel Command, where we were doing contracting and purchasing for the Air Force. I was responsible for the financial logistics, and defending the budget was one of my duties, and I traveled back and forth from Wright Pat to the Pentagon to defend any budget lines we might have that was going to be cut. And that was key, because in order to be sure that all of the planes could be flying, spare parts for aircraft was one of our main items of defense, because that was something that was very necessary. And for that individual that knew nothing about what we were doing, to say, arbitrarily say that this is a line item that can be reduced, no. And I felt that this was something that my boss gave to me to do because he felt that I could do it. And I was received, and received all of it. I got these looks when I walked in the door. A woman. What do they think she can tell us? But I was able to convince them that I had the necessary supporting information that was necessary for them to make their decisions, and they were going to have to listen to me. I spent 3 years there and went back to Europe, and I finally got to do what I had been wanting to do from the very beginning as a chemist, and that was to be a special weapons officer. Not only was it special weapons, but conventional weapons as well. And I could mix a mean napalm. Again, young men took one look and said, a woman? But I soon persuaded them that I was just as capable or more capable than my male counterparts. And that was who I am. Okay. While stationed at Ramstein, if you will recall, this was the era of John Kennedy. And John came to Wiesbaden and to Berlin. Ich bin ein Berlin, his famous statement for it. And we did a static display at Wiesbaden of all of the weapons that we had in our inventory. And we went along with the weapons officer and the weapons maintenance officers, and we did our static display.
That was for JFK?
Yes. And we did get a note back from the president in his own handwriting that said it went to the commander. Job well done. That really raises the morale. It raises the morale of the troops and everyone else. And it was something that I felt that here I finally get a chance to do what it is that I wanted to do. And someone paid attention. We had a shipment. We're using those things now. Cluster bombs. But they were brand new in 1961-62. And they came in as top secret shipments. They could not be flown to Ramstein. And they could not be shipped by a German carrier. So what we had to do was the teams of officers, airmen, we drove our own trucks to Bremerhaven to offload these ships and bring those weapons back. But there was one truck, and we're close to the German border in Bremerhaven. You can go up to colony to get into Germany, I mean to Russia real fast. We had one driver who stopped on the road. And he said, I am sick. I need to stop. Can everyone else pass us? And I had a young man who had more foresight than I that was riding with me with the weapons. And he cocked his 45 and he put it to his head. And he said, you're well. Drive. And this, I will sure now that this man, he was well. He was fine. We were going
to
take. He was trying to sabotage something. And had it not been for that young man, God only knows where we would have been. Because he was faster on his feet than I was.
Was the driver an American or?
No.
They were German.
They were German drivers. German drivers, but we had a shotgun, someone riding shotgun along with an officer in each truck.
Mm-hmm.
But we got them back, later found out they were cluster bombs. And cluster bombs were some dangerous little suckers in the wrong hands.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting. And we had a stockpile of warheads that the inventory, I'm sure now, has prevented me traveling to quite a few places, because I'm told that somewhere in the back of my mind, I still carry that knowledge. I don't believe it, but I'm still to this day controlled by where I can travel.
Mm-hmm. Interesting what our minds do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and from Germany, I went to Amarillo to supply officer school that I needed to be upgraded. And it was while I was in Amarillo that John Kennedy was killed. And we were in class, I remember, we were in class, there were 12 of us in that class. And someone walked in and said, the president has been shot. And we were all stunned. And later, the teaching had long since fallen by the wayside. And we sat there talking back and forth, like, what does this mean? And before long, someone came and announced on the loudspeaker system that the president was dead. And it was as though someone had launched us. 12 officers rose to their feet, like someone had said, you know, tension, hut! And all came to attention and rendered a silent salute. It was, I could never feel that again, that my hair just stood up on the back of my neck. That's part of being the core. Part of being the core. I went on to drive from Amarillo to upstate New York to Griffiths Air Force Base.
Where was that?
Griffiths Air Force Base, another depot. I never got to be in base supply until much later. But I went through the depot and I arrived at Griffiths on the 9th of December, 1963. And I find out the base is going to be closed. Or the depot is going to close. And why am I here? Oh, give me a break. But I had been specially requested by a former colonel that I had worked with at Wright-Patterson who was there. So therefore I went into the supply depot and later became GEA, part of GEA, which is Ground Engineering and Electronics. I controlled all of the ground radio and airborne radar worldwide.
Tell me again what that stands for, ground?
Ground Engineering Electronics Installation Agency, GEEIA.
Installation Agency.
I put the cart before the horse. It's electronic engineering.
And this was still while at Griffith?
Yes.
They closed the depot, but...
They closed the depot, but I moved over into another job.
Okay. Okay, and you controlled then there. Tell me again.
The airborne radar that's installed in aircraft across the United States and abroad. We kept inventories. I had inventories at four different locations in the United States for which I was responsible for. And that was so that you could have those airborne radar sets centrally located for anyone that needed a part or needed a new unit. You couldn't keep it all at one location. You had to decentralize so that it was available. But then I had these people at those various locations that was responsible for those inventories. I can recall one incident where President Reagan had a team of consultants, of college professors, and was wondering why it was necessary to have these units on as many aircraft as we had them on. And I can recall that the message came down: the inventory is too large, you need to reduce your inventory. And you can eliminate them from X number of aircraft, which the commanders agreed, and we were able to. We started taking them. I sent my teams out to go around and take these radars out of the aircraft. We no sooner got these radar units out of the aircraft. You got to remember now, the aircraft are normally flying below 5,000 feet with the aircraft so they can make detection. And here's when the Russian MiGs landed in Florida. And that's because we couldn't detect them. We had taken the units out of the aircraft below 5,000. So, I'm sorry. Back we went.
Where did the professors fit into this?
Remember when he was at... come into office and he was being advised. And this was an advisement that was, well, because I say unless you're really working or exposed in some way, have some general knowledge of what's going on, it's hard to make a decision about something if you know nothing about. I can recall back when I was in Vietnam, we had some congressmen and legislators came and decided that we should release Hamburger Hill. And President Johnson at that time sent out a message to General McMorland, who immediately got on his plane and flew to Washington and said, here's what we're doing and here's why we're doing it. Oh, we're sorry. Just because they see something. B-52 flying over Hamburger Hill, when you drop a 750-pound bomb, it's like dropping a marble on a granite hill. But you got to realize the effect psychologically on what it's doing on people. And we had control. But stopping the bombing took us out of the realm in which we had created as control. Which, that's what happens when you've got people who don't know what's going on, but think they know. All the more reason, good briefings before you visit an area, let you know what's going on.
Right.
So from Griffiths, I went to Vietnam. And we stationed at Tan Sanud. And this was when, this was in 1968.
Now, the visit by the congressman, was that before you were stationed there or after?
No, that was after I was stationed. It was during the time that I was stationed there. I came in and was assigned to the 377 Combat Support Group. As a management and procedures officer within the chief of supply.
Management and procedures.
In other words, I was managing, seeing that the policy and procedures were in compliance for the 100,000 items that we had in storage. That entails maintaining, to see that the inventory officer was performing the inventory, that records are being kept, and do periodic internal inspections. And in addition to that, we found, that many of the more women were coming into the theater. I was assigned an additional duty as WAF advisor for the enlisted women. This was a real education for me, both in Korean culture and also in the overall combatant environment. It was an education for me to learn to deal with being in an area of combat, but also in an area where the Vietnamese were trying to maintain their culture. And maintaining their culture, regardless to a war effort, was first and foremost in their lives. And survival was of the fittest, because in order to survive, they found that there was many things that they had to do. And I found that they weren't as effective in maintaining the family as they should. Because, for instance, Asians have always felt that women were useless. And if a woman gave birth to a female child, she would get rid of the female child, which meant putting it on a garbage dump. And if you put it on a garbage dump, it could be attacked by rodents. And I have a Sergeant Downing, and the two of us would visit the garbage dumps, and we would find these babies, and we would take them to orphanages. And I am deathly afraid of rats and mice, and you can chase me a mile with a mouse. And when you're afraid, you do things that you normally wouldn't do. And I saw this infant being attacked by mice, and I waded into that to get this baby, and we delivered them to an orphanage there in just outside of Saigon. I can remember Christmas Day 1968. The orphanage and the nuns who ran the orphanage, they had pittance in order to sustain and keep. And food was just at a minimum. That they were lucky if they got one bowl of rice a day. So we had a plane come in and land, coming from Australia on Christmas Day with Christmas presents for the Australian troops. And it was loaded with fruit, apples and grapes and oranges, and pallets of rice. Well, we waylaid a pallet of rice, busted. And we loaded it into the back of a pickup truck. And we drove through some hostile areas to deliver that rice to that orphanage. And the only thing they had to put it in was some old sheets. And we swept that truck out because we were to sweep it. The nun said to use the broom to sweep it. And I'm thinking, you don't want that to land there. But yes, they did. Once we swept the truck out, the bed of the truck, into a pan. And then she took the pan and she put the rice through a screen. And the debris came out into the screen. And then she washed it. And we watched her wash it. And that was the very first rice that she cooked for the children, was what the debris, not the main part of the shipment, but the debris from the shipment, what she used for the very first meal. I learned how to be frugal and thrifty and survive. It was because of some of the things that we did in support of the local people in the community that my boss put me in for the Vietnamese medal, and also nominated me to the Unsung Heroine Award that is by the VFW women. And that particular year, I gathered that there was well over 400 women who were nominated for the Unsung Heroine Award, and I came out number 4, so I feel good. There was a squadron of security police, and every night they went out on the perimeter of Tan Son Nhut. So they would be the first line of defense if someone would try to overrun the base. And I would stay there every night until they had gone out. Several of us would sit there and we would say goodnight to them as they would go out on the perimeter. And sometimes we would go up, like Christmas Eve, we took donuts and up on the line for them. Just being friendly. But being friendly, I found gained a lot for me, because when I rotated to come back to the United States, by the way, we went in to Vietnam on Braniff planes, and if you remember Braniff Airlines, their planes were bright colors. They were green, you name it, they had all different colors. I came in on a yellow one, and I wanted to go out on a yellow one. Yellow bird, she sits on banana tree. Well, there was a yellow plane when I was going to leave. And I thought I was going to miss the plane because I had to be there. 7 o'clock in the morning, it processed me through all my papers, and I'm sitting there waiting. They're loading the airplane. And every time I went to the door to get up, stand, Major, you're going to have to wait. Give me a break. Let me get on my plane. My seat's going to be gone. Oh, here comes a general or another officer through. They get on the plane. Okay. Is there going to be a seat left for me? Okay, it's time about 5 minutes before takeoff. Major Johnson, you can board now. Oh, yes, you can board now. Finally. Oh, boy, and I say goodbye to my friends. And when they open that door, I still get tears thinking about it. They have found all of these security police who worked that 7-6. And they had formed an aisle from the entrance all the way to the plane. And I had to walk through that gauntlet of military and shake those hands as they said goodbye to me and thank you. Nothing else has ever happened to me in my lifetime as much as that did that particular day. That's why I couldn't get on the plane. I love them all. Wish I knew where those young men were today. Mm-hmm. Back to now, coming from Vietnam.
When did you come back?
In 1969, June of 1969. And my mother had lived with me for quite some time since the death of my father. And we had two Cocker Spaniels. And being from Chicago, I had said to her, Mom, please don't go back to Chicago while I'm in Vietnam. I would really worry with you walking the dogs on the streets of Chicago. Please don't do that. Let's just stay here in the house. And then whenever I get my new duty station, we'll worry about putting the house on the market at that time and then make the move. Okay? Fine. She was satisfied with that. And I had lots of friends and the Air Force people that would take care of her while I was gone. I was sent back to Griffiths. I didn't have to look for a new house to move. Thank God we did, because I would have really been upset if we'd sold the house, put it on the market, and I wound up going back to Griffiths. I went back to Griffiths and back to Gia, where I stayed until I retired.
And that was, your retirement was?
November 1970.
So that's 34 years ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what have you been doing in the meantime, Dan?
In the meantime now, I went to work for the state of New York for the Division of Human Rights. I was an inspector with the Division of Human Rights, inspecting industry on discrimination of women in the workforce. And I did that for almost a year and a half. When I got a call from a representative at McDonnell Douglas, and McDonnell Douglas was going to offer me a job managing parts for the F4C aircraft. And I'm talking about now in 1971, which was a good job, you know, 71, 72, a good job. It was going to pay me about $45,000. And in the meantime, I took a job at Hamilton College. And I'll tell you why I took the job at Hamilton College. My father was an English professor, and after he had been with the Postal Service, he went to teaching English, wrote speeches, speechwriter for many politicians. And he had said to me, whatever you learn, learn it well so you can teach it to someone else. If you can't teach it, you haven't learned it. When I came back from Germany, I landed in New York at Travis I went from Travistown, New York, to pick up my car. And I had to stay in a motel for the night because my car had been shipped over by boat. And it was at the Brooklyn Neighbor Yard, and it was Labor Day. And that was the year that Martin Luther King gave his speech in Washington. And I watched on television all the proceedings going on in Washington and saying to myself, you haven't made any contribution. In fact, I was out of the United States every time something was going on. I had never been a participant in the issues that were being addressed. Those same issues that were germane to civilian life was also germane in military life. And Chris, what are you going to do? And I sat there, felt sorry for myself. Why aren't you doing something? And immediately, when I got my car, left my mind. But when I went for an interview for the job at Hamilton College, one young lady turned and she said to me, you wouldn't take the job if you were asked. And I said, why do you say that? She said, most people of color that has attained a certain status or place in life, they're not interested in young adults. They're only interested in themselves. And I said, this young woman is bitter. And I went out and I did some research, and she was right. And I'm talking about in this era of the early 70s. You didn't have people giving of themselves. They were busy taking. So then I said, oh, well, I don't have to worry about that, because at my age, they want someone closer to the age of those young people, so they're not going to ask me. Well, by God, they called me and they offered me the job. And my mother said, she had an expression that when you did something irrational, they threw out the baby with the bathwater. Well, I turned down that job for $45,000, and I took a job for $13,000. And that's what I have been doing for 33 years.
All of it at Hamilton College?
All of it at Hamilton College. Many things that I've been doing for 33 years. And as became a lobbyist for higher education for the state of New York, I've been on the school board. I was elected by my peers in Rome, New York, serve on the school board. There are many things that I've been doing. All has to do with young. The reason I got involved was for young people and for education. I adopted a young man that was, they told me, was retarded. There was nothing wrong with that child. It was just that he had been so severely abused because he was a lefty. He had been beaten to make him into a right-handed. So therefore, he didn't talk at all. He didn't do anything. And all of his motors were out of sync. I needed to do something, not only for other young people, but for him as well. So consequently, I went on to involve myself in community. I involved myself in many things. An effort, I would have to say, another one of my great achievements, in addition to that walking through the gauntlet with the aircraft. He came home to me one day when he was 7 years old, and he said, I am not a Sambo, am I? And I said, what are you talking about, a Sambo? Well, all the kids are laughing at me on the school bus, calling me a Sambo. And I said, I remembered, there was a sign on the way to the house, said Sambo's restaurant's coming. I went down and talked to my lawyer to see what I could do, and he said, Chris, I don't know, but we can try something, whatever you want to do. So I said, well, this is only a tenth of a mile from my house, and I really don't want something that's going to be within a tenth of my mile of my residence referring to me as a Sambo. We wrote to the lawyer saying, we understand you have a name called Jolly Tiger. Can't you use the Jolly Tiger rather than Sambo? And he said, well, it's a combination of the names of the two owners that have gone into this effort, and therefore, and I said, yes, I know that, but why do you refer to all of the characters in the book, Looks Like Black Sambo? And he said, well, I don't know. And I said, well, I want to know. The lawyers came from California, and when they got there to interview us to see what my problems were, they said on the telephone where we could overhear, oh, there's the one woman here and a country hick lawyer. We should be on the next plane within the next hour. So, and he didn't realize that the man that was my lawyer was a regent, an educational regent for the state of New York. So Imlin turned to me and said, Chris, this isn't going to cost you anything, but we're going to do this. We got an injunction that stopped construction. And when they stopped construction, they agreed to put the Jolly Tiger on. But in the meantime, everything else, the menus, was all being printed with Sambos. We went to the judge in Albany, and the judge said, you're in violation of New York State's human rights law. Now, remember, I was been human rights, so I know the law. And you're going to have to close all restaurants in the state of New York until you come in compliance. And he said, well, you can't do that. And he said, yes, I can. Well, I got on the phone with their owners, the major stockholders, and they agreed to change the name. However, in the meantime, the New York Times had given us a lot of coverage because of Imlin's affiliation with it. And we had, Boston had joined me in my suit, and other cities in New York, and other cities in Cleveland, Ohio, and in Philadelphia joined me in the suit, Johnson versus Sambo's, to the point that they went bankrupt. And consequently, all of their restaurants were closed. I knifed my son. The system does work, sweetheart. There's a lesson to be learned. The system works. It's just that we have to persevere. You can't give up. It took us 3 years, but we did it. Now, the little boy that started the singing, Little Black Sambo, Little Black Sambo, niggers live in houses infested with roaches, niggers live in houses infested with roaches. If you will recall that it's during this era that Roots came to the television screen. Well, Alex Haley is a very dear friend of mine. He was a dear friend of mine. And he had taught at Hamilton, where I was now working, and he had been a writer in residence. So that when he came back to Rome, New York, where he had written his book, he took Eddie in the car to show Eddie where he used to live. And it happened to be the house where the little boy was living. Well, needless to say, my son, I just smacked his ass. But he got on the bus the next morning and said, you live in a rat-infested, roach-infested house. You live in a nigger house. Did you know that?
Oh, what a story.
Oh, let's give me a break. Needless to say, I had to go down to school. But I have my students that I was directly responsible for. When young people, I taught young people how to study, how to think, and how to reason. How to read a textbook. And many of these young people were very successful once you were able to develop their innate skills. What they missed in high school. High school's guilty of a lot of infractions, but I have well over 800 graduates. And my 800 graduates are doctors, they're lawyers, they're entertainment lawyers. I have a former student that is the agent lawyer for this young man, Rodriguez, that's now going to the Yankees, that's going to get $126 million. His lawyer is one of my former students. The people that are being successful because of the time that I took going back to my father saying, if you learn it, you learn it well. Teach it to someone else. So being an applied epistemologist for the last 33 years was finally my calling. Never knew it until I got into it. But teaching was my calling. I've been all over the books, as you well see. And what am I doing now? I'm tutoring young people. Teaching them how to read. That couple seven-year-olds. I went to a wedding, the wedding of my son, in 1994, I think it was. And we had a new president at the college. And the new president had been given an agenda, and he had to hire some new people, fire some old people, and hire some new people. And he had, on Mondays, he had fired these people, three officers of the college, and I had gone off to the wedding of my son. And he called while I was in Arizona. I said, oh, now, what's wrong? Well, I guess I'm the next to go. And I finally got him on the phone, and he says, how's the weather in Arizona? And I said, it's nice. Gene, why did you call me? He said, Chris, I'm just trying to find out when you're going to be back in New York State. And I said, well, why? I wasn't in a hurry to come back. You know, I've still got some time to use. He says, well, you're going to have to be back. Because Governor Cuomo has nominated you and has been approved as the outstanding African-American of the year. And that was another milestone. That's because of my involvement with youth and lobbying for youth causes. I need to be lobbying again because our youth in San Antonio
and Texas.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a marvelous story. A truly remarkable, remarkable life and career. And your contributions have been phenomenal. And even in the military, you said it was not until after the military that you began to at least articulate that mm-hmm. you hadn't contributed to the situation. Mm-hmm. But through your story today, it's quite obvious that as a woman and as a woman of color and a military first enlisted and then officer, mostly officer, that as a role model and a mentor, if you weren't filing lawsuits or turning over barrels, you were still contributing significantly.
That's why my son, I adopted a child while I was in Vietnam, one of those. And I couldn't bring it back to the United States. It had TB. And I couldn't bring it back, but first of all, I was single. And the next thing was that not only was I single, but in those days, officer, enlisted, whatever, women could not have minor children.
You had to sign them over to somebody else if you had one, but it just didn't happen. You didn't dare get pregnant, or you were going to be drummed out of the court. So therefore, but I knew that I was going to be retiring within the next year and a half, so I wrote back to then Al Perney, who was the congressman who tried very hard. He said, "Chris, there's nothing I can do about that child. She's going to have to leave that child in Vietnam. However, the state of New York is going to allow single people to adopt children." I said, "Oh yeah, you're trying to appease me." Ah, okay. So I went back to New York, and I had been maybe 6 months I'd been there when I got this application from Al Perney that was all filled out, and all I had to do was sign it. And 6 months to the day that I filled out that application, I became the first single parent in the state of New York to adopt a child. And they took me through all kinds of difficulties. I had to come up with pictures on both sides of my family. And they wanted to be able, this child should come to this single parent with some semblance of looking like other members of the family, not to create a psychological problem. Oh gosh, you wouldn't believe it. But this was, they were new at this, so I did everything. I got pictures of both sides of my family, my nieces, my nephews, my mom, my father, you name it. I sent it all in. And out popped these five kids. And there's no way that you can tell that Eddie does not belong to me. But I'm looking at this kid. My mother said, "Oh, you're beautiful." So I said, "I want to see him. This is one I want to see." And the adoption clerk said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. That's not one you can see because he's retarded. He should not have been in the dispatch. They were going based on genetics, buildup, and everything, but the kid is retarded." And I said, "I want to see him. I don't care what you say to me, I want to see him." Well, at this time, this was in 1970, early part in spring of the year. There was a riot in Syracuse, New York. And in the black ghetto area, there was this big race riot. She said, "Well, I can't get in there. I'm white. I can't get in there to get him." So the woman said to me, "Tell you what, though, but if you drive, and I'm not supposed to do this, because you're not supposed to know where he is. If you drive me in, we can go and do this." So I said, "Okay," and I'm in uniform now. But we didn't have any problem because I was in uniform. And we drove in, and we pulled up in front of the house, and the neighbor came out, and she said, "There's nobody home there." But she says, "I recognize you. Aren't you the social worker?" She said, "Yes." She says, "That youngest child is in the house, alone. Now you see, he's two years old." She said, "And he's tied to a chair, the high chair, in the basement. That's where they keep him." I in turn called police. Police came, she was able to get on the phone, get a court order, that they could break into the house. Because of the riot that was going on, it was easy for her to get the court order. And, of course, to get the police in there, and they hit the police and broke down the door, they thought, "Oh, what's going on here?" Well, anyway, needless to say, this kid, I didn't go in. I wasn't allowed to go in. I'm glad I didn't. He was tied to a high chair. And the high chair was sitting on a piece of paper, and he had something like gruel or mush in his plate. So they took him out, and she said, "We're going to have to take him. If you want him, you're going to have to take him now." I said, "There's no way you're going to get him out of this car." I took this child home to my mom. No, I didn't get home to my mom. I said, "What about his shoes?" She said, "He doesn't have any shoes." You know, I didn't get any shoes. So I stopped at Sears and took him out of the car and went in, and put him as measuring his foot. I don't know why this man took this kid's sock off, but he took the sock off and he looks at me, looks, and this kid's toenails had all grown into his feet. They'd turned and grown into his feet. And I'm saying, I'm in uniform. You, how could you? I said, he's not mine.
Yeah, I know. He couldn't have been.
Well, anyway, needless to say, I took him to immediately from there to a podiatrist. They had to give him a shot in both feet. My mother still hadn't seen him. Gave him a shot in both feet and cut those toenails out. And I took him home to my mom. And she said, what have you done?
Mom, I don't know, but we got to do something for this child.
I couldn't leave him where he was. He was so filthy. And he had cradle crap. All, it was just, she took baking soda and she washed him down because we couldn't put him in water because of his feet. But when the feet healed, we tried to put him in the bathtub. Could not. And could not get him. He was just stiffened. So then the psychiatrist said he had been placed in water that was too hot. He said, you've got to let him fix the water. Let him play in the water with his hands. As soon as he plays in, he knows what the temperature is. He tried to, I said to, you know, he was trying to feed himself. And you look up and, oh, good boy. Immediately called up the base, got emergency, threw him in the car, drove to Walter Reed. We were there for 4 days. They said, this kid has been severely beaten. To make him from left to right, you got to give him everything in that left hand. There's nothing wrong with this kid. You tell that by his eyes. Nothing wrong with it. First time he did a belly laugh when he saw Mickey Mouse. Oh, look. And that's, oh, I can't talk. Look. He's a beautiful 34-year-old man now.
What a wonderful story. Your entire story is just inspirational, Chris. And thank you for sharing it with us. Providing us with this.
But when my son, I want you to meet my son when he comes to visit me. I really do.
And what I would, Chris, this has been a very, very remarkable story of your entire life and career in the military and in human rights. Thank you for doing it.